All right, good morning. It's a privilege again to speak to everyone. As you'll find... Oh, this is mine. I can't forget this. As you'll find out, today, these stands are awful. I own like six of them. I had to conduct... I wrote an opera and I conducted it. We all use these. They fell over constantly. It was not fun at all. It was a comic opera, but that wasn't supposed to be the funny part. We'll see how this works. I might have to hold it. It's all right. We can improvise. So I've been told there are somewhat high expectations of me today. Thank you. Expectations of me today. And because of that, I've decided to preach about the dangers of high expectations instead. But actually, let's just stick with the original plan. So my series is called Myopia. Talking about spiritual nearsightedness, not physical nearsightedness. I am very, very nearsighted, but we're not speaking about that. We're speaking about the spiritual side. When you focus on one aspect of God to the exclusion of others, and this is dangerous because God is not limited to one thing, and when we limit him in this way, I think, as you'll see throughout the series, there are major, major consequences for the church. So to sum up last week... Quick summary. I feel that, having grown up in the evangelical church, we emphasize a very small part of God's nature. And that part is the idea that it's all about just simply following God, simply obeying. Everything else is sort of chaff in the wind and should be blown away, and we should just focus on this really narrow aspect of God, really with a heavy emphasis on sharing the gospel. Sharing the gospel is the end-all and be-all of being a Christian. And it's very important, no doubt, but focusing on this to the exclusion of other things actually does weaken the message itself, I believe. And I think the answer to that, the antidote, is Jesus' own words in John 14:6, where he says, I am the way and the truth and the life. He's setting up a three-faceted, it's hard to do numbers when you're holding something, a three-faceted view of his nature, that he encompasses the way, which is following after him, the truth, learning and knowledge gained of him, and the life, which is enjoyment of the life that God gave us. So that's an all-encompassing nature. There's no part of our lives that is unaffected by this. So no longer do we have our secular life and our sacred life. Everything is sacred, if you think about it this way. And I just summed that up. Okay. Not there yet. So last week I said that I tend to think autobiographically when I'm developing a new idea, when I'm investigating something, because I have to come up with a question, something that bothers me. It's not an easy question, and I have to wrestle with it. So I've realized over time that I've been in lots of different evangelical communities, and they were all wonderful. Like, there wasn't a community that didn't have a heart after Christ that I participated in, wasn't really pursuing him. And it's a wonderful community to be in, except I realized that more and more, I am almost nothing like them. And this was weird because we both love Jesus. How can I be so little, have so little in common with all of these people? And when I originally ran this sermon, I spent like 45 minutes on personal stories and realized that's way too much. So I'll just tell one. And this is when the differences were first clear. Growing up in like elementary school, I kind of thought, yeah, I'm pretty similar to everyone else. We have the same interests, a lot of the same interests spiritually and everything. And then in junior high and high school, I got into this wonderful youth group at our church. My parents, we switched churches, in high school, I think. And it was very healthy for me. This church was very focused on Christ and had a youth pastor who really kind of understood me pretty well, I felt. I feel like I'm in a bathtub. Really understood the way I thought, my values, and things like that. And it was very, very encouraging. It was a healthy environment initially for me. And I was surrounded by these friends who were all passionate about Christ. And I thought, in the same way as me, I thought we were similar. So when I had the opportunity to go to a big Christian, high-powered Christian conference, I took it up. And for those of you that know me, you think you can already see the train wreck that is coming, because I am not a conference person at all. Not anymore. But I didn't know this then. And in preparation for going to this conference, it was a big one being held in Columbus, Ohio. I grew up in Ohio, by the way. It's held in Columbus and at a big convention center. And all of my friends, we were so excited going up to it. And some of them had been last year, the year before, and they told me, like, it was just life-changing. forgot to time myself. It was life-changing for them. And they were expecting, you know, to never be the same again. And so I was expecting this. I thought, this is going to be amazing. It's going to change everything for me. And it would, but not in the way I thought it would. It was sort of a negative thing. So we get there, and we're ushered into this huge arena. And it's just filled with other people our age, other teenagers, and everyone's worshiping God. And it's so high-powered. And for me, I am incredibly introverted, which is weird that I like public speaking, but there it is. I'm incredibly introverted. Don't like big groups of people I don't know. You guys were super welcoming the first time I came here. Still mildly terrifying for me. But, yeah, very introverted. So immediately I'm kind of overwhelmed. But they're all friendly. They're all Christians. They're all worshiping God. This is a safe environment, right? And it was weird. It's funny how we think of loneliness as being off by yourself, being separated from other people. But really, I think you're at your loneliest when you're surrounded by people you feel you have nothing in common with. And this is when it first dawned on me. I'm among this, like, thousands of people all worshiping God. They're passionate. They're jumping up and down. They're waving their hands, you know. And I was never a hand-in-the-air type of guy. I don't know. I can't do it. But anyway, they're all doing that, and they're enjoying it. They are having, it's very clear that this is a transcendent experience for them. They're touching the very person of God through this. And I felt nothing. And I felt nothing more keenly because everyone around me was so engaged. And I looked around, I just remember thinking, this is awful. What am I doing here? I've never felt this before. Church has always been a safe place. And after the music finished, I kind of thought, that was weird. That was a one-time thing. And then the speakers came up. And the conference is actually really well organized. They have this theory that for teenagers, if you switch what they see every 5 minutes, they'll actually pay attention, like changing the channel. And it does work. So they would do little five-minute bits of a sermon, and the same guy would speak over the course of the day several times and kind of piece it all together. And they would do skits, and there would be videos and all this stuff. And as they were speaking, I was like, this is like Sunday school. I mean, this is like Sunday school 6 years ago. This is really low-level stuff. I am not engaged. And they would do skits about, you know, sharing your faith in a scary situation, and it was really trite. Like, in the skit, there would be, you know, a hostile kind of bullying-type person, and then the other person would share their faith, and they would be, like, immediately converted. And I thought, this is in no way reflecting the actual difficulty of sharing your faith, which is scary, and you have to really pursue it and be obedient, and, you know, oftentimes you don't see the fruit. And so at the end, I was thinking, okay, we're going to talk about this the whole way home, like about how, you know, this is really disappointing. And they even told us right at the end, we had to all go out through the convention center. They were like, now that you've learned it, you can apply it. So we accosted everyone else at their conventions and shared the gospel with them. And I've heard other groups had a lot of success, actually. The Spirit blessed them. My group was just, you know, awkward the whole time. It did not work. So that was my first experience with, like, cold call evangelism, and it was not pleasant. But as we're going home, it was weird. Everybody in the van was just celebrating. This, they said, you know, it was just what I thought it was going to be. It was life-changing. It was amazing. And I was just quiet. I was just like, what happened? How could I go from at the beginning of this weekend, I thought these were people that were like me. I was part of a community. I was invested. And then by the end of it, I'm just like, I have no idea what happened. I am nothing like these people. The only thing we have in common is that we love Jesus, and I didn't know what to do. And after that, it got worse. Over time, throughout high school, even as I became closer to individuals in the group, I realized more and more that the vision of the church as a whole was, I was moving away from it. That wasn't the same things that I valued. And I thought that college would be a solution. You know, you're your own person. I was able to choose my own spiritual groups and all this stuff, and that didn't alleviate it. Every group I found was the same. I felt like it wasn't a home. I couldn't be me. I had to kind of hide, like, you know, they would say something, I would think, oh, that is not logical, but I have to be kind. I shouldn't point it out, you know. Or they would say something like, this is beautiful, and I think, oh, it's really not. Because I study aesthetics, I study beauty, and it's, I don't want to be elitist because that is a real problem in academia, but you know, it's really hard when someone calls something wonderful, and it's hard for you to imagine that it is, right? And so I came up with this question, and it really troubled me. How can two people, is that too small? It looks small. I'll read it. How can two people share a God experience? You guys know what I mean? Like anything that we taken to be from God. How can two people share a God experience that sees one refreshed and leaves the other empty? how is this possible? How can something that gives life to one believer feel like it kind of is draining for another? Because I saw this all the time. I saw it when I was on the side where I didn't feel the life, like I related to you, but I also saw it when I was excited about something. I remember coming to friends in college, because I thought, it's college, everybody's, you know, a little more, you know, heady, they're a little more intellectual here. So I would, like, the first time I read G.K. Chesterton, the first time I read Orthodoxy, I was like, this is amazing. He has this way of making you see the world in a new light, see the glories of God, see the wonder of God in a new light. And I tried to share it with the guys in my Bible study, and just wholesale rejection. They wanted no part of it, because they say, I don't need to think about the world that way. I don't want to, you know, read this Englishman who's twisting his words around. He's like the Willy Wonka of English writers. You know, scratch that, reverse it, all the time, making you kind of turn in on itself. But they were totally uninterested, and it was so hard to feel like, this is God to me. This is something I love about him, and it's just complete rejection. And it was only later that I realized that I was doing the same thing to them. You know, when they shared experience that was really meaningful to them, you know, when they prayed and just felt the presence of God, or when they, you know, took a step out on a limb and witnessed to a coworker and saw God work there, I was uninterested in that. I didn't value that either. And it really struck me, like, this is an important question. This is the cause of a lot of conflict, especially for, I think, people my age, where we're seeing a lot of these sorts of people who think differently in the church or in the at the fringes of the church who have Christian friends. And we have to figure out how we can address this. So I began to search in Scripture. I had found this John 14:6 last year. So at the sense that God has three facets to his nature, I thought, surely there's a verse that talks about our responsibility, a verse that asks us, how do we respond to these three facets? And then I found one in Deuteronomy 6:4-5. This, if John 14:6 is sort of, for me, the linchpin of the New Testament, the identification of who God is, Deuteronomy 6:4-5 is the linchpin of the Old Testament. It's what we are supposed to do. It's our responsibility. And just for fun, we're going to do it in Hebrew. Does anyone happen to speak Hebrew here, real quick? No one can correct me on pronunciation then. I think it's close. So first of all, though, we have to practice a new sound that we don't really have in English. Can everyone act like you're disgusted? Act like I just said something that was awful and just go, ugh, ugh. That, ugh, that's what we need. I'm not going to do it into the mic because it's very loud. But the ugh sound, you're going to need that every time you see a CH or a KH. Ugh, okay? So repeat after me. These are the very words of God. Shema Israel. Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Nice. Ve'ahavta et Adonai. Good. Elohecha bechol. Levavka uvechol. Try it again. Levavka uvechol. Good. Navshcha uvechol. Morecha. A for effort, right? In the last line, Ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. Good. Amen. And in translation, I know it, that says, Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone, or the Lord is one. It means both at the same time. Love the Lord your God with all of your heart, and all of your soul, and all of your strength. And then the last line is what Jesus himself said, and love your neighbor as yourself. So this is something I actually say multiple times every day, because in my mind, these are the very words that Jesus himself would have said. This is something that a Jew was commanded to say every time they got up, every time they left the house, every time they returned. It sort of centers yourself. It's our responsibility. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, and all your soul, and all your strength. Now, the Hebrew words for heart, soul, and strength, they don't map perfectly onto the Greek words for way, truth, and life, but they're really close. And I wouldn't expect two completely different languages to map perfectly like that. If you study languages, you know the meanings just don't do that. But when he says love, Moses writes, love the Lord your God with all your heart, the heart, one of the definitions of heart in Hebrew is the part of yourself that feels joy, the part that enjoys. So this heart maps really well onto life, because life is about the abundance of life and enjoyment. So this facet of life, we have a responsibility. Love the Lord your God with all your heart. Love the Lord your God with everything that you enjoy. Next, love the Lord your God with all your soul. Soul is sort of a tricky translation because it's really talking about your rational mind. It's not just talking about, like, sort of... I never knew what love the Lord your God with all your soul meant, because your soul is kind of your spiritual self. So this is love the Lord your God with all of your rational mind, with everything you know, with all of your debate and your discussion and your wrestling with ideas. This maps really well onto the facet of truth. And then the last one, love the Lord your God with all of your strength. And the word for strength, it's purely a physical force here. Love the Lord your God with all of your effort. And that is about action. So it maps really well onto the facet of the way. So here we have God telling us to respond to him. Now, he's already said that he has three facets, right? I'm the way, the truth, and the life. Now he's saying, I want you to respond to me along all three facets. So this sort of gave me a benchmark for maybe this is what the ideal Christian looks like. But I still had this problem. How can two different people experience these same things differently? How does that work? Why should we have this problem? And as I was driving home for Thanksgiving, it's like a 7.5-hour drive for me to get back to Southern Ohio where my parents live, I had a lot of time to think about it. And I eventually realized, you know, Paul talks all the time about spiritual gifts, and he indicates that we're different. We get different spiritual gifts, and it's part of God's sort of gift to us, crafting us in such a way that we fit right into his plan. So I realized that not only that, God gives us different spiritual affinities. I like the word affinity better than personality. I've read a few papers over the week that other researchers have figured out that there are these different spiritual personalities, just like we have personality tests or spiritual ones. But I think affinity is a stronger word because... Oh, there's the translation. I did write it. An affinity means an inherent likeness or agreement, close resemblance or connection. We, each of us, have a strong affinity for one or two of these facets of God's nature, and we usually have one or two that we don't have a very strong affinity for. This is a blessing. This is God giving to you a special love, a special liking for a part of himself. And this is a gift. It makes each of us different. It makes us all fit together in this sort of tapestry of the church very nicely, but it also makes us argue and fight and have division, unfortunately, because of human nature. So, as an academic, I naturally decided that I needed to name and define each of these affinities, because that's what academics do. We think it's fun to give things names. So I named them this way. We have the spiritual affinities for the way, the truth, and the life, these three facets. The names I gave them were sensates, erudites, and aesthetes. You can think of sensates as feelers and doers. Their focus, the locus of all of their interest in their spiritual life, is on feeling the passion of God and putting it into action. That is who they are. Erudites are thinkers. The focus of their spiritual experience is on wrestling with the truths of God. This is what gives them life. And aesthetes are dreamers. Their focus is on experiencing the beauty of God and seeing it all around them. There are four questions that we can ask that help us better define. And if you are interested in a kind of like a spiritual personality test, you can sort of rate yourself for each of these questions, like, I don't know, 1 to 5 or whatever you want, and see where you really fall with each of these, how true the statements I'm going to give you are of yourself. So the first question is, how do they determine truth? And this is maybe one of the biggest sources of contention, because if we determine truth in different ways, if we value truth in different ways, we're going to have a lot of doctrinal arguments, right? It makes a lot of sense. How do they measure their walk with Christ? How do they figure out the answer to the question, how are you doing? How's your spiritual walk? They do it in different ways. How are they refreshed? How do they feel reinvigorated with spiritual energy? Because we expend it all week, right? And church is kind of supposed to be the time where we get to replenish the spiritual energy so we can go out and spend it again for the glory of God. And lastly, where is their life joy? I love this word. It's a very Chestertonian word. G.K. Chesterton used it frequently. And it's this idea of not just joy, not just life, but the joy that brings life, the joy that makes you feel like you can almost touch heaven itself. That's life joy. It's a special moment. We don't get it often. But what brings this is the question. So first of all, with truth, how do the sensates, the erudites, and the aesthetes, or the doers, the thinkers, and the dreamers, how do they react to truth? For sensates, it's all about personal experience. For them, a truth is confirmed when they've seen it lived in someone else's life, or they've lived it themselves. And by the way, sensates by far are the vast majority of the church. And this has consequences that I'll talk about next week more. But when you think about typical evangelicals, it's the top, the red one, the sensates. And they're all about the personal experience. That's why they love testimonies so much, because testimonies are giving them an example of someone living out a truth in their lives. So if you tell them something abstract, it is less meaningful to them than telling them a story, than saying, oh, no, here's a truth. Yeah, it is abstract, but here is it lived out. That's what they want to see. Time. Okay. Erudites, fairly obvious. They like rational tools. They like to use logic and observation. It's pretty straightforward. That's how they determine truth. Most erudites would probably say that, how can anyone determine truth differently? These are literally truth-telling tools. You know, this is the way you do it. I have, if you can tell, some affinity for this. It makes sense to me. But then aesthetes. If you guys remember my sermon back in November, I talked about, I think of life as a story. For an aesthete, you are constantly building up this worldview, and you're building up this story and how you fit in. And what you look for is bits of truth that fit the story you've already made. This is why artists are so hard to witness to, because if they've built up a worldview that excludes God, they have to tear it down before they can accept God. It's really difficult to witness to artists. But the nice thing is, once an artist is a believer and they built God into their worldview, it's really difficult for them to lose that, because everything they examine, they say, does it fit the story that God gave me? Does this truth fit in? All right, next, we have the walk. How do these people describe their walk? So sensates measure their walk by passion and action. I like to think of them having like a passion cup, ooh, like my cup, except mine's not very full. That might be accurate. I'm not terribly passionate about things sometimes. Anyway, they have like this passion cup, and they want it to be overflowing. When it's overflowing, when they've been filled up, then they feel closer to God. But it's not just that. If their passion cup is overflowing and they're not using it, it's frustrating. They want to have passion and then channel it in to action. They want to be able to unite those two. That's why I think they love these conferences so much, because they get pumped up and then they get to do something. And this is, for them, is their spiritual experience. In contrast, for an erudite, if you ask them how they're doing, the answer will probably depend on whether they're discovering something about God. Constant discovery refreshes and encourages and fills up an erudite, a thinker, as well as right thinking. If they're struggling with something, if there's a doctrinal issue or just any intellectual question that they can't solve, it's really frustrating, and that's when they feel like they're most lost. And last of all, the aesthetes. For them, it's the direction of the story. The worst thing that can happen to an aesthete for their walk is to not feel like they know where they're going. For me, basically most of college, I was like, I have no idea what God's end game is here, and it was just deadening. I hated it, because I wanted to have a sense that I'm participating in God's story and it's heading somewhere important. That's what a dreamer really needs. They want to see themselves moving somewhere in the grand scheme of things, not just an immediate solution, but an overall one. Next, refreshment. How do we replenish our spiritual energy? For a sensate, for a doer, it's by doing. It's pretty straightforward. If they can actually be working with their hands, they're pretty happy. That's how they know that they're growing in their faith. Usually when they're falling away or they feel like they're really struggling is when they can't do anything, when they've been distracted, when they're too busy, when they don't have a passion for it. You know, they need to unite those two things, the passion and the doing, together. Erudites, it's pretty simple. They like to discover new things and they like to have discussions. An erudite all by themselves is probably an unhappy person, because they have to be, striving with one another. They have to be having these good, long intellectual discussions with their friends to really tease out the truth of God. That's when they're refreshed. And aesthetics, by experiencing beauty. For me, when I want to feel refreshed, I go back to a song or a poem or something that's inspired me in the past, usually, or I find a new one, and I just can just revel in the beauty that God made. And that's how I just really relax and feel my energy building back up, and I can go on from there. And the last one, life joy. What causes these sorts of monuments in your life, these landmarks that define a major change? And it's different for each of the groups. For the sensates, It's the feeling that God is involved in their passion and action. You might see a pattern going through for all of these. But I think when I talk to my sensei friends, the things they mention the most are when they acted in faith and they saw God work. When they had an experience where they weren't necessarily expecting, you know, to see him there, and God kind of pokes through and it's a revelatory experience. These are their moments of the greatest life joy. So when their action is rewarded with basically seeing God, right? The thinkers, it's when they have a change in knowledge. You might not think that someone who is more on the intellectual side would like sort of having a whole worldview shift, but it is very exciting. And when you sort of have that clarification, it's just, that's a very significant moment. For me, when I begin to realize these sorts of things about myself, like that the reason I had such trouble in church is that God made me fundamentally differently. He gave me a love for different parts of himself. That was a revelation, and that was invigorating for me. That was a moment I'll always remember as a moment where I felt closest to God. You know, these sorts of changes where it feels like you only had part of the picture and now you have so much more. It's very special for a thinker. For a dreamer, for an artist, it's expressions of beauty, but usually it's the first time you hear it. I remember all of my favorite songs, all of my favorite poems or works of literature or the works of art. I don't know much art, but what little I do, all of those that are my favorites, the ones that inspire me most, I remember the first time. And that's when it just overwhelms you, the beauty. You can't see anything but God in it. Those are special moments, and that's what I remember. Those are the moments that bring me the greatest life joy. So the question is, what do we do with this? You know, if you agree that you can kind of see some of these characteristics in yourself and those around you, what does it mean? Well, I used to work at this very, very conservative Christian camp in Michigan. And one of the first things they did when new counselors arrived is that you took a personality test. And it was based, if you know the Greek humors, the phlegmatic, sanguine, choleric, and melancholic, it was based on those, but they gave them fun animal names so you wouldn't have to say phlegmatic, choleric, melancholic, and sanguine. Instead, you said, what was it? Otter, beaver, lion, and retriever. And an animal represented each one. And you took the test, and then you knew, like, for me, I'm a beaver retriever, which means I'm detail-oriented, a little bit moody, and very non-conflict prone. Whereas an otter is fun-loving and not much else, and a lion is terrifying because they're incredibly competitive and a little bit acerbic. So anyway, I didn't get along with lions. I'm a little bit afraid of them. But you found out what everyone was, and then you could communicate better. Like, if I was assigned a task with a lion, I would think, just get through it. Just don't say anything. Just don't make them think you're competing. You're just cleaning the table. That's all you're doing. That's all you have to do. But the funny thing is that really helped. Understanding how they thought about themselves and about the world around them actually helped me deal with them better. If an otter was washing dishes with me, they would know that they can make a little game of it, but not too much, because I'm detail-oriented and that will annoy me. And I knew that I could make a couple jokes and the otter would feel much more at home. And the retrievers are just easy to get along with because even if they're irritated, they're not going to tell you. So, you know, they're kind of a wash. But anyway, you can see how this helps. Understanding each other actually helped us communicate. And if you ever had a problem with someone, you just casually ask someone, what personality type are they? And when inevitably they said lion, I said, okay, I get it. You know, they're competitive and scary. So, but this helps. Now, with spiritual personalities, I think what the important thing to remember is, what do they love? A doer, the doers, the feelers, the sensates, they love that passion, that action. They like having that simple faith that is really focused. So if you don't want to bother them, if you don't want to hurt them, don't, you know, lessen their faith. Don't devalue what they love. And that's the mistake that I made. My response to those experiences in high school and college was generally to think, well, everybody's just shallow. That's what it is. They just like this emotions, you know, they like emotions. They like to go out and do something, but they don't see the consequences of their action. They don't see the big picture. And some of that is valid. Every one of these affinities has valid criticisms. But the important thing is they're all valid experiences of God. They're all real and authentic for the person experiencing them. And I did wrong by lessening what they were doing. But part of why I did that is because of their response to me. Every time I brought up something intellectual, every time I admired something I thought was beautiful, it was devalued. They said, this is kind of a side thing. This isn't really necessary for faith. This is complicated. It needs to be pushed to the side. We need to focus just on Jesus. And I think therein lies the key. If we're going to grow, and I'm sure I'm short on time, right? I need to get out of here soon. my timer is saying so. Okay, excellent. I'm almost done. I think the biggest takeaway is instead of thinking, what can we do? How can we bridge this gap by force, you know? I'm sure you could try to experience something from a different facet. You could try to kind of explore. But, you know, we have these affinities for a reason. I've tried, you know, being a sensei before. I'm really bad at it. I don't like it. And even if I went and made that effort, I don't know how much good it would do. But what we can do is stop tearing each other down. When you're tempted to, you know, write off someone's experience as being of lesser value to you, remember that this is how God speaks to them. So if you're not particularly intellectual, you don't necessarily have to force yourself to read Orthodoxy, even though it's amazing and you all should, and it's free because it's out of copyright. Bonus. Even if you don't like that, you can give value to someone else's love of it. Even if I personally hate the question, what did you learn this week? I can give value to the fact that that's important to someone else, that they feel they do learn something every week, and they feel they can articulate it apparently in a sentence or two. I can't do that, but they can, and that's valuable for them, and I probably shouldn't even make fun of it there, because it really does, it tears down. When we lessen the value of what someone else loves, that's what is most hurtful to them, I think. So, we can hopefully apply that a bit. I'm supposed to make an announcement, and I just remembered because I wrote it down. The prayer team will be by the window, and I'm going to close in prayer.